I love watching football. Since a young age, I've just adored the sport. I think the pinnacle of my enjoyment came in 2012. I was in Barcelona supporting Chelsea in the Champions League semi-final. The captain of Chelsea had been sent off. The other centre-back was injured. We'd given away a penalty, which Messi somehow missed. But we were holding on, against all odds, about to reach the biggest game in club football. And then this happened. Fernando Torres, the so-called flop of the century, lamented for being largely useless and costing an eye-watering £50 million, scored, cementing Chelsea's place in the final. In the highest seat in the ground, at least 100 rows above the pitch, me and around 3,000 other fans went berserk. It was a magical moment, the most enjoyment I've had from watching football. And since then, I've been on a bit of an interesting journey. I've learnt much, much more about football. I've spent much more time playing it. I've read books by analysts examining the game. I listen to podcasts about tactics, YouTube videos about XG, and follow niche stats like expected assists, ball recoveries, and dribble success rates. And yet, despite learning more, I think I enjoy the game less. Learning more has sort of taken the magic out of the game. I've never had a moment like that night in Barcelona since. And in general, I just don't find watching football as enjoyable as I did before. Maybe I've grown out of it. Maybe I'm deterred by the commercialization of the sport. But my guest today thinks it could be something else. She's researched this phenomenon and she's found something surprising. The more you learn about something, the less you'll enjoy it. All of that coming up in this episode of Nudge. The podcast I'd like to recommend today is the D2C Pod, brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. The D2C Pod is a podcast all about all the things direct to consumer. The hosts cover everything from starting, growing, and optimizing e-commerce stores and D2C brands. If you're interested in the stories behind your favorite consumer brands, this is a podcast for you. To start, I'd suggest checking out episode 318, which features the CMO of Feastables. So, listen to D2C Pod wherever you get your podcasts. Today I'm chatting with Sarah Moore, Professor of Marketing at the University of Alberta. Here she is talking through her work.
Yeah, most of my work looks at language, either stories that consumers tell each other in terms of word of mouth, or communication between firms and consumers. And that might be in customer service. It might be in advertising. It might be in social media. So I look at kind of using or not using different words in that communication and how consumers respond when you use certain pronouns or when there are swear words in online reviews and what the consequences of that are.
Today, Sarah is well known for her groundbreaking research in online reviews and word of mouth. I'll share more about that in a bit, but first, here's Sarah sharing what inspired her research.
I read a paper that referenced a psychology paper, and the idea of that psychology paper is that sometimes we have experiences that we can't actually capture in words, and that if we said something about them, that translating the experience from just being an experience into some kind of verbal analog, that you lose something inevitably when you do that. And I thought that was really interesting. So I went and did some more reading. And then I found Jamie Pennebaker's work. And he's done lots and lots of stuff in psychology on trauma. He started in trauma and looking at how talking about and writing about trauma helps people, can help people recover. But it depends on what they say. And so he's done a lot of work that shows kind of as you write about traumas, if you build them into a narrative and if you kind of explain, if you make sense of them, why did they happen? Why did this happen to me? Who are the characters? What are the reasons behind all of these events that you feel better? And so that big idea of kind of sense making turned into my dissertation work. And it just kind of happened. happened that at the time I was starting to do it, online reviews were kind of becoming a thing, and word of mouth seemed like a really clear marketing context in which to look at making sense of and explaining experiences. And I went from there.
Later in the episode, Sarah will help me understand why I might enjoy football less the more I learn about it. But to start, I asked Sarah to share her research on word of mouth reviews.
Word of mouth has been around in communications and marketing for a very long time. Marketers were talking about word of mouth, academic marketers were talking about word of mouth in the 50s, but it used to be really, really hard to study. Some of the old studies did things like looked at piano teachers' students or used army bases where they could map everybody's social network and they could really figure out who was talking to who and who was recommending what to who. And so that was really challenging work to do when you had only face-to-face word of mouth, in-person word of mouth. And the field has really exploded since online reviews and online word of mouth came around. And since at the same time, we've got all of these amazing kind of text analysis tools that we can use to study them in a way that is much faster. So most of the work on word of mouth traditionally looks at kind of what you can think of as like the outward ripple of word of mouth. So I tell you something, you decide you're going to try this restaurant or adopt this product, then you tell someone else about it, then they tell someone else. So there's this exponential nature, which this network effect, which marketers really love, which makes a lot of sense. But nobody had thought about what happens to me when I tell someone about an experience that I had, and whether or not the way I tell someone about it changes how I feel about it. And if that will change not just how I feel about the experience, but my likelihood of repeating the experience, or even my likelihood of telling someone else about it in the future.
Sarah wanted to know if sharing a review changed our perception. If I tell someone that I love a coffee shop, does that make me love it more? If I explain why I think Fight Club is the greatest movie of the 90s, will that make me enjoy the film more? This is what Sarah decided to research.
So I got people to write me word of mouth stories. I tried very hard to give them instructions about how I wanted them to write me the story. So I would tell some participants, please just tell me about an experience you had at a restaurant. I would tell them either to recall a positive one or a negative one. And if I let them kind of write their own narrative, then I could code it for whether they were either kind of making sense of the experience and explaining it, or whether they weren't, or the degree to which they were explaining. But if you tell people to explain or to not explain, that does not work. People can't do it. And so what I ended up doing was giving people these kind of to actually manipulate how people were writing about their experiences. I gave them this kind of Mad Libs fill in the blank story. So I'd say, think of a restaurant experience. And then I would give them this story shell that was like, last night I went to blank with so-and-so. Or so they would fill in all these blanks and I would have a few words in between. In the explaining condition at the end of a few sentences, I just added a because or a since.
Sarah compared two types of reviews. One type of reviews where reviewers simply shared their experience. For example, I keep going back to McDonald's. And then other types of reviews where the reviewers actually explain their thoughts behind the experience, explain why they think they're having that experience. So, for example, the equivalent would be, I keep going back to McDonald's because it's really consistent. There's this comforting familiarity I get in every bite. Sarah wanted to know if one of these two types of reviews changed our perceptions.
And what happened was, if you manipulate it so that you can get people to explain an experience, which people tend to do naturally for negative experiences and for extreme experiences. And we also spend quite a bit of time explaining things in the world. That's one of our basic motivations, because then we can predict what's going to happen next time. So it's not an unusual thing to get people to explain, but I needed to do it in the experiment to figure out what would happen so that I could compare. the explaining to the not explaining folks. So when you get people to explain, if they explain a negative experience, then you get the same pattern that is in the psychology literature for sense making and for trauma, which is that people start to get over the negative experience. So it becomes less negative as they explain that they went to this restaurant and they had a terrible time. Maybe it was because the restaurant was busy, maybe because they were in a bad mood, maybe because they ordered the wrong thing. As they start to add these explanations on, the experience becomes less negative because it becomes more cognitive and less emotional. So that's a great thing for negative experiences. It's a good thing for consumers to kind of be recovering from these negative experiences. It's also a good thing for marketers if you can get consumers to explain their experiences and not feel so bad about them. You might not want them sharing negative word of mouth in doing that, but the other kind of implication is that the same thing happens on the positive side. So if you have an amazing word of mouth experience, a restaurant experience, a travel experience, a movie, and you figure out why it is that it was so amazing, why it is that you love it, that also takes away from the emotionality. So you like it a little bit less than you did before. And that makes you less likely to talk about it in the future and less likely to want to repeat that experience. So we get this kind of dampening effect of explaining on evaluations. But that happens only for emotionally based experiences. So experiences that are hedonic. So things that we do because we expect them to be pleasurable, like movies or restaurants or travel or books or music. For utilitarian experiences, which we do because they're functional, things like tax software or batteries, when you explain those kinds of experiences, you actually get the opposite pattern. Because they're less emotional and more cognitive to begin with, when you explain why you love your tax software so much, or alternately why you hate your tax software so much, you get this polarization effect. So understanding those cognitive experiences better actually makes us feel more strongly about them instead of less strongly, which is what happens for the emotional ones.
I find this fascinating. If you get more loyal customers to explain why they love your coffee, why they love your pizza, why they love your artwork, after doing so, they might actually love it less. Explaining why you love something reduces your enjoyment, but only if that experience is hedonic, if it inspires emotion. For utilitarian experiences, like the software you use to file your tax, explaining why you like that will actually make you like it more. This made me wonder. Could marketers be strategic in the way they ask for feedback? Could they ask for reviews in a specific way to maximize a customer's enjoyment or to minimize their dissatisfaction? I asked Sarah.
There are ways that you can do it that will kind of guide consumers through talking about and thinking about their experiences in particular ways. Some of that would need to be implemented by the online review platforms. And that could be things like, first of all, more of a, instead of just a, like, here's a text box and here's where you put the subject line and here's where you put the star rating, a more structured review process where you first ask them kind of what category they're going to write about. If it's somewhere like TripAdvisor, then they're almost all going to be hedonic experiences anyway. Maybe you ask them what category it is. Maybe you ask for their star rating sooner. And then given what their star rating is and whether they're writing about something that's hedonic or utilitarian in nature, then you could give them different review writing guidelines or walk them through what it would be helpful for other people to hear about or what it would be helpful for them to write about kind of for their own sake. And that could change depending on the type of experience and the type of the positivity or the negativity of the experience that they had. And you could also apply that not in a word of mouth context, of course, in a customer service context as well. Once we know what it is that people are upset about and what kind of experience it was, then we can help them walk their way through it in a way that will help them recover or maintain their positivity.
I shouldn't ask loyal Nudge listeners why they love Nudge. It might make them enjoy it less. But I should ask those who hate Nudge to explain why. In doing so, they'll probably readjust their dissatisfaction and end up enjoying the show a little bit more. So far, we've only covered customer reviews, but I was keen to know if this works in other aspects of life. Could my love for football really diminish the more I learnt about the sport? Well, find out after this quick break. Finding a service solution that helps you better connect with customers and keep them happy can feel impossible. It's like trying to remember the name of someone you've just met at a networking event. I've made this mistake before, introducing a colleague to my new friend Dan, only to find out his name was actually Ian. Being personal with your customers is important, but keeping on top of all that information can be very hard. That's where HubSpot's all-new Service Hub comes in. It brings service and success together on one powerful platform for the first time ever. It's got an AI-powered help desk and an AI-powered chatbot that handles frontline tickets fast. Plus, it comes with a customer success workspace that helps reps anticipate customer needs. Plus, it never forgets a first name. All of that can help you scale support and drive retention and revenue. That means better service and happier customers at every stage of the journey. Visit hubspot.com/service to do more for your customers today. Welcome back. You are listening to Nudge with me, Phil Agnew. I'm keen to know if the effect Sarah has found in her studies apply to other aspects of life. She reckons it does.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to Pannenbaker's original stuff, and it's the kind of big lesson, which is, you're right, broader than my research and in lots of other research, is that there are some things that you shouldn't try and figure out. So when someone asks you why you love them, don't answer why. Why is not the kind of question that you want to answer, is not the kind of thing that you want to think through for things like, why do I love this person? Or why do I love this vacation spot? Or why is this my favorite book? It's better in those cases just to rehearse or rehash those feelings and the experiences and what happens in them without pulling it apart. So I have a really concrete example from when I was a kid on the negative side that kind of, I think, captures how explanations can really take emotions away. So I was kind of a wimp about movies when I was a kid and did not like watching real people movies for a very long time. We only watched cartoons. And then finally, when we were getting a little older, we watched Jurassic Park, which was a little scary. And there were all kinds of dinosaurs and they were crunching bones. And me and my sisters were a little petrified by the whole movie. And then we found out afterwards that the sound of all the bones cracking in Jurassic Park is a waffle cone being snapped inside a toilet bowl. And that's how they made the noise. And as soon as we had that piece of information, that explanation about where the sound came from, that changes it completely. It's no longer emotional at all. Now you hear it very differently and you understand it very differently, and therefore you respond to it very differently.
Trying to explain your emotional feelings towards someone can make you enjoy those feelings less. Explaining why you love someone will dampen that feeling. It removes the magic. By rationally explaining your love, you lose that feeling of love. You enjoy the love less. But that's not all. Sarah has shared how learning how something was made, like the bone-crunching noises from Jurassic Park, made her enjoy the movie less. And this feeling has been studied.
There is actually a new paper, not my paper, that looks at expertise. And I think it might be wine. People who are experts, who have all of this cognitive baggage, scaffolding, information in their heads about experiences in particular. And wine is a really good example. People who have training in wine have a ridiculous amount of information about what it's supposed to taste like and how you're supposed to describe it and how you're supposed to evaluate it. And this paper shows that that also is dampened, and that experts don't experience, because they have all of that, what I think of as cognitive baggage, because they have all of that their experience is constrained by that. And that's not a bad thing if it's your career and if that's how you experience wine, but it's a less intense way of experiencing it than someone who is a novice, who doesn't have the scaffolding, which sometimes is helpful to understand your experience and to kind of predict what kinds of wine you might like to drink in the future. But it also changes the experience and makes it more cognitive than it otherwise could have been. So in some ways, sometimes it's damaging because you get to a place where you can't turn it off, right? You have this, you have so much knowledge in your head that you can't taste a wine without bringing that knowledge to the experience. I imagine musicians are similar, right? People who compose music or who are really good at making music, I would imagine have a hard time going to the symphony and listening to it in a way that a novice would.
The more I learn about football, the less I enjoy it. Just like Sarah says, learning about stats like XG, ball recoveries, and the intricacies of VAR makes me enjoy the experience less. It turns a hedonic emotional experience into more of a utilitarian one. It's the case for writers who struggle to enjoy reading a best-selling novel without pulling apart its flaws. Or movie critics who fail to laugh at the comedy because of janky cinematography. Or take even taxi drivers who can't enjoy a tour bus ride because the driver changes gears too often.
I imagine musicians are similar, right? People who compose music or who are really good at making music, I would imagine have a hard time going to the symphony and listening to it in a way that a novice would.
There's a lot to take in here. It goes against a lot of conventional wisdom. So I asked Sarah for some final takeaways that all of us can keep in mind.
I mean, I think it goes a little bit in both directions. So on the positive side, if it's an emotional thing, try and preserve the mystery. Don't try and figure it out. Don't figure out what the secret ingredient is in your favorite dish at your favorite restaurant. And on the negative side, I think we tend to think about kind of everyday negative experiences as things that we don't really need to cope with. We think about kind of big traumatic things as things that we should see a counselor about or that we should figure out how to deal with on our own. And part of the interesting outcome of my dissertation stuff is that you can do that for having a bad coffee experience or a bad restaurant experience. And if you can feel a little less bad about those things, then that's not a bad thing either. And you do that by figuring out why they were so bad. And that also can help you avoid it in the future, hopefully.
Perhaps the solution for me is to take a total break from football, to stop watching football for a few months or perhaps a year, to release my obsession with stats and data, to forget about form ratings and to forget about transfer spend, and instead come back later like a bit of a novice, not aware of every player's stats, but just able to enjoy the game for what it is. And maybe if I do all that, I'll enjoy football just like I did 10 years ago. That's all for today, folks. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode of Nudge. If you did, perhaps refrain from loading up the next episode straight away. You might enjoy it a little more if you wait. That said, if you do want some more Nudge in the future, you can follow me on LinkedIn. I'm Phil Agnew on there. I share 2 or 3 tips a week on LinkedIn, so do follow me on there and you'll get a lot more behavioral science advice every single week. Or you can subscribe to my newsletter. Every Friday, subscribers get a behavioral science tip on anything from marketing best practices to studies on whether you should explain why you love someone. So click the link in the show notes to subscribe to that newsletter for free if you want to sign up. Massive thank you again to Sarah for coming on the show. She'll actually be back on Nudge for a future episode soon, so make sure you subscribe to the show so you don't miss that. And thank you for listening. I'll be back on Nudge next Monday for another episode. Cheers.